Life in the Rainforest. Within a few days, I found myself 7 stories up a giant machi mango tree, hanging by a slender rope over black waters where people were fishing for piranhas. My purpose here was as absurd as my position. I was looking, as usual, for dolphins. On previous days, with our guides Moises and Mario, we'd explored several lakes in our canoe and found my friend Paul was right. There are many dolphins here. But again, like at the meeting of the waters, watching them was like a giant shell game. A piece of a dolphin would appear, then disappear, and we could not predict where it would show up next, or whether the next dolphin we saw was the same or a different individual. From our perch in the canoe, the water's surface seemed like a trap door that only the dolphins could open, and which slammed shut with every dive. Earlier we'd tried to pass through that door at Charo Lake. Less than an hour's journey downriver from camp, past the handsome, stilted village of Buena Vista, the 1,200-acre lake is shaped like a figure eight, with a big mimosa poking its crown up from the middle. The dolphins like this lake in the high water, Moises said, and in fact, in the distance, we saw several right away, rising slow and low. It was safe to swim here, Moises told us. No piranhas. Perhaps, I hoped, I could see the dolphins better if I were underwater, too. Gratefully, Diane and I slipped over the side of the canoe and into the cool, wet darkness. The water wrapped around us, weighty and sensuous as a black satin sheet. Then, expelling my breath like a dolphin, I sank wholly beneath the surface. I opened my eyes. I often swim with eyes open in ponds and lakes at home and in the sea, and I find I see fish and plants quite well. But here the waters were black as night, and I could not even see my hands or feet. Beneath the water, weightless as an astronaut, I felt as if I were floating in a night sky bereft of stars. The dolphins were still at the other end of the lake, but now we couldn't see them at all. Perhaps they would come over and investigate us. And in fact, after some time, Moises called out to us that dolphins were approaching. Once they came within 20 yards of us. But the visibility was even worse than from the canoe. At eye level, every wave now was as tall as a dorsal ridge, and because our ears were clogged with water, we couldn't even hear their breath. We splashed to attract them. We swam toward them and away. We floated serene as lilies, but they never came closer. So we swam, just for the pure joy of it. And after we had swum for many minutes, Moises said softly, "Don't pee in the water." "Oh?" asked Diane, alarmed. As usual, she'd been drinking coffee steadily since 4 a.m. and had brought in her voluminous camera bag an enormous thermos full, which she had just emptied. Twice. "Kandiru?" I asked. "Kandiru are surely the most dreaded fish in the Amazon, far more feared than piranhas. Attracted by urine, these tiny needle-shaped catfish are known to lodge in the human urethra, where, secured with backward-pointing spines, they are impossible to remove without surgery. One British author, Redmond O'Hanlon, had been so intimidated by the possibility of getting kandiru stuck up his penis that, before visiting the Amazon, he'd constructed an elaborate codpiece, which included, as I recall, a kitchen strainer. Diane and I, though, were completely safe. Kandiru do not frequent blackwater rivers. At least that's what the books had said. Moises was pulling our leg, as I could tell by his sly smile. But there were other things in the water, which we could feel but couldn't see. One of them, a fish, an electric eel, a water snake, had plucked a Band-Aid off the sole of my foot. It could have been a dolphin for all I knew, for even when we shared their waters, they were invisible to us. So this was what I was doing up the tree, trying once more to penetrate the black waters. I hoped at some height to be able to stare down through the water, to be able to see the dolphins swimming below. I was making slow progress. The climbing apparatus is a harness type affair, the same gear that mountain climbers use to scale cliffs, with leather loops that grip you around the tops of the thighs and across the pelvis, and a hangman's noose for one foot. You step up into the noose like climbing a stair, and, straightening the leg, push yourself up. Then, with your hands, you slide a knot the length of your step up the rope and take another step again. At first, I was so nervous and clumsy, I shook with exertion and fear. But after the first few yards, I felt the treetops calling me up. The Machimongo was a muscular, sinuous creature, wider at the base than our canoe was long, whose every movement over many decades was now recorded in the architecture of its woody flesh. Unlike in North American forests, it is easy to see here that plants, like animals, are creatures on the move. You can almost feel the force of limb growth and root grip, the grasp of coiling tendrils, the seductive swellings of flower and fruit. Like animals, plants are hunters. They hunt light, and they are willing to kill to capture their prey. The strangler fig to my left as I climbed had arrived as a seed that became wedged in the crotch of a large tree. Decades ago, the baby plant had dropped its aerial roots down the trunk. Fed by the nutrients, the sun-hungry young leaves of the fig had surged skyward, while the plant poured forth more roots like wax dripping from a lit candle. Years ago, the roots had eventually run together, finally entombing the nursery trunk in its clasping loins. Philodendrons use a different strategy. The seedlings first pursue a tree trunk, and once there, climb to the top by growing modified roots. Eventually, the stem dies at the tree base, severing its connection with the soil. Arriving at the treetop, the plant may wander farther. If its spot is too shady, it can move to a better location by building more stem, growing in front and dying behind. If the spot becomes too dry, it can drop new roots to the ground. And unlike most epiphytes, many philodendrons do not die if they drop to the ground. They simply begin their climb upward all over again, to perch harmlessly on the host tree without robbing its nutrients. As I climbed, I willed myself the strength of a philodendron. Up I climbed, past snails clinging to the undersides of leaves, up past an inexplicable frenzy of gnats, up past the big mud termite nest that hung like a clump of drying tobacco in an adjacent smaller tree, up past a spiky-leaved bromeliad as big around as a Volkswagen. Up I climbed, up past a bird's foot philodendron with leaves shaped like the outstretched fingers of giant hands, up past the remains of the dreaded wasp's nest, up, heave, straighten the leg, pull up the rope, push up the knot. Now cobalt-winged parakeets zoomed by at eye level, and yellow butterflies floated below, and still I climbed, up, past the grasping tendrils of a liana, up past a brown termite nest larger than a pumpkin, up past another bromeliad in whose teacup-sized bowl I could see mosquito larvae swimming, and up. I finally made it to the top of the rope, high enough to catch the scent of the tiny white epiphytic orchids. They smelled like vanilla. Now I looked down at the water. It was still and impenetrable as night. Rain dripped from the trees as we set out for the lake in the morning to search for the dolphins as before. The high water had created new waterways, and with Moises at the bow and Mario at the stern, they threaded our canoe between the tops of low-growing trees. We traveled at eye level to birds' nests and bromeliads, and we could peer into the holes where toucans and parrots were nesting. Strange lives clung to every tree. White-lined sack-winged bats, perched in the lee of leaning snags, angled like tiny bracket fungi. To attract females, the males deposit saliva in special sacs in their armpits, and then, once it ferments, they wave their wings to waft the scent toward prospective mates. Fist-sized, hairy, megalomorph spiders, which we commonly, though incorrectly, call tarantulas, hunt for nestling birds in tree holes. In the way of all spiders, they envenom their prey, liquefying the flesh and then sucking it dry into the stomach, which is located in the head. Every bough, every trunk, every vine around us swelled with life. conical billed or pendulous flew from grassy, purse-like nests hanging from the tips of branches. Ants boiled out of huge black excrescences on trunks. Brown centipedes curled in the crevices of bark. Vines coiled up trees into minarets, bowers, crenellated chimneys, and then trailed languidly back into the water. Every day we went out to watch the dolphins from our canoe. Each day we visited a different body of water, even when we returned to the same one. One day we would find Charo Lake had turned as purple as an amethyst. Another day it would shine silver. One day at TB Lake, when we watched a mother dolphin and calf, the giant lily pads, big as throw rugs, were full of lurid, white, butterscotch-scented blooms crawling with shining beetles. The next time we came, the flowers were gone. On a misty morning at Domingo Lake, a 9-foot seasonal pool that goes dry in the summer, where the dolphins were hunting catfish, we saw a baby perform an unusual, spectacular leap, showing us its whole body. And as we returned to camp, we spotted a spider web that stretched 15 feet long, perhaps 4 feet high, draped across the lower branches of several waterlogged aquabiche trees. Moises said that perhaps 10 fishing spiders had worked together to create it. We had passed this way several mornings before and never saw it. The mist had made it visible. The only things that seemed relatively static were the sloths. On the way to Domingo Lake, we passed 3 of them in a mimosa tree, their shaggy fur green with algae that grows in their hair. When Moises whistled, they turned in slow motion to reward him with imperial stares. Diane wanted a photo of one and hoped it might move into a better position. But Moises told us, utterly deadpan, "That sloth, she gonna move tomorrow." The next day, there she was with her companions, still in the same tree. To get to the lakes, Moises took us on shortcuts through the looking-glass world of the flooded forest. We often squeezed between partially submerged trunks of thorn-fringed astocarium palms. Even though it was our boat that was moving, the spines seemed to lunge at us. When we saw them coming, Diane and I would call out, "Spines!" and pull our legs and arms close to the center of the boat. Often, just as we were retreating from the spines, one of us would then notice that a low branch was also looming at face height and cry, "Branch!" warning the other to duck. Sometimes our canoe bumped the trunks of the spindly little cecropia trees, which grow like weeds in the high water. Small, aggressive ants then rained down on us, into our hair, down our shirts, into our gear, and we would cry, "Ants!" Ants live at the hollow base, where the 9-lobed cecropia trees attach to the stem, and feed on nectar-producing organs on the leaf blades. In exchange for this favor, they protect their host by attacking and biting anything that touches it, as we soon discovered. But Moises was unmoved by our dismay. "But they are not poisonous," he would say, paddling demurely ahead while we picked ants off our skin and threw them overboard, only to find that they could swim and often crawled right back into the boat. The only ants that really commanded Moises' attention were those who injected venom strong enough to disable a person for a minimum of several hours. One of these species inhabits the hollow Tangaranga tree, and we quickly learned to identify their host's elongate oval leaves. The giant Paraponera ant also garnered Moises' respect. With a glistening black body over an inch long, it possesses a hypodermic-like stinger with such a large venom reserve that can sting over and over again. The venom is potent enough to incapacitate even a strong man for a day. Then there are ants who bite and sting, such as the Odontomachus ants. They lurk under every log and, when disturbed, gush out like blood from a wound, making the sound of crumpling paper when their feet hit dry leaf litter. "This guy," Moises told us, pointing to one of them, "he grab you with his front, then he sting you with the back." Despite the spines, spiders, and ants, the waterways through which Moises threaded us seemed far safer than the land. One afternoon, Moises took the 4 of us, Diane, Jerry, Steve, and me, for a hike through the rainforest. At first, every step seemed booby-trapped. We suspected that each log concealed biting ants and poisonous snakes, that trees would drip upon us toxic sap and venomous caterpillars, that vines would trip us and send us stumbling into palms which would stab us with their stinging spines. "Be careful," warned Diane as we started our walk in the sweltering heat, "especially everywhere." Stephen was the best prepared of us four, for he had visited the Amazon the year before with his mother. Sliding down a stream bed, his mother had broken her leg. He was stung by fire ants. A river of army ants invaded their camp and occupied it for 3 days. Fortunately, Steve likes ants, so this was actually a highlight. So was the time when a column of army ants hunted him. He had been out in the forest, watching a line of leafcutter ants stream by, each holding aloft in its jaws a swatch of leaf like a little flag. These ants comprise 39 species in 2 genera, all of them gardeners. They harvest small pieces of leaves in order to create giant underground gardens of a fungus found nowhere else on Earth, their only food. The amount of vegetation cut from tropical forests by one genus of these ants alone, the Atta ants, has been estimated at 12 to 17% of all leaf production in the South American tropics where they are found. Steve had stood transfixed by the flow of these tiny workers, taking photos with his macro lens. Then, out of the corner of my eye, I noticed ants on the left side of the trail and decided to take a photo of them too, he said. And suddenly, the column of them breaks off and heads directly for my feet. I turned around, and the entire path was closed off with a sheet of army ants, he told us. I had no choice but to run right through them at full speed, but I was taking pictures the whole time. I kind of figured if I was going to die, someone would find my camera, and they'd know what got me. Fortunately, though they did bite him, they never made it up his pants. Steve had been attacked by another kind of ant, with mandibles as long as its head. It first bit, then stuck its stinger in the wound pierced by the jaws, and vigorously pumped venom from its abdomen into the wound. Chiggers also crawled under his skin. He'd even been stung by a tree. Because Steve admires weapons, it didn't surprise me he collected spines. He had found one trunk covered with spines shaped like Hershey's Kisses, and reached for it. Moises had tried to grab his hand, but it was too late. The tree stung him. It injected some toxin that made my hand throb for hours, he said. I later dissected the spine. I could never see a mechanism by which it could do this, he said. The Amazon is like some nightmare, he said, where nothing behaves the way it's supposed to. He saw birds fly out of nowhere, perch in front of him, stare him in the face, and fly off. A toad ran. Not hopped, he stressed, but ran, away from him faster than he could keep up with it. In the Amazon, he found, one is constantly confronted with realities that simply can't be. Just that morning, canoeing with Graciela, his Spanish tutor, and Juan Salas, the camp handyman, Juan had tried to knock a tarantula off a tree for Steve to collect. It had fallen out of sight, and Steve remembers telling Graciela not to worry. The spider can't be in the boat. But no sooner had he spoken than he saw the giant, hairy legs of the spider crawling up over the gunwales. Steve kept a journal recording his experiences, and toward the end of his first expedition he wrote, "This was a great trip, but now I need a vacation." But Moises saw a forest in an utterly different way. He had grown up with the Indians along the Napo River, one of the Amazon's tributaries arising from Ecuador and flowing into Peru. He pointed to a vine with reddish bark, thick around as an anaconda. "This guy," he said, "he give you good survival water when you were lost in the jungle." He whacked it with his machete and hoisted the severed stem over our heads so its cool, fresh water poured into our mouths. He shoved the severed vine back into the ground, where he told us it would grow. A few steps later, he sliced a great gray-green tree trunk with his machete. First, it oozed red like blood, but then white sap welled up and dripped like cream down the smooth bark. "This guy," he said, "we call arbol de leche, milk tree. He give you strength in the jungle for 2 days. The river people," he explained, "also use its milk to treat anemia, and the sap can also be boiled to yield a glue to smear on perches to catch birds." On the trunk of another tree grew a little black swelling like a gall. This Moises lit with a match, and it burned like an oil lantern. A A little beetle lives inside the gall, he explained. This guy, he said, referring to the beetle, causes the tree to make a tar, which the people use to seal their blowguns and burn for light in their houses. Moises referred to every plant and animal in this forest as this guy. When we saw bewildering, erratic growth, Moises saw a forest full of characters. Like people, some of these characters, the Tangaranga ant or the poisonous bushmaster snake, could harm you. But others, like the red water vine, the milk tree, the copal gall, offer cool water when you're thirsty, food when you're hungry, and light in the darkness. I remembered what my friend the ethnobotanist Mark Plotkin had lectured to a New York audience years before. A Westerner looks at the jungle and sees green. But after his first contact with the Indians of the Northwest Amazon, he realized an Indian looks at the jungle and sees a grocery, a hardware store, a repair shop, and a pharmacy. Mark has spent more than a decade recording the extensive plant knowledge of tribal people like the Tirios, Wayanas, Waiwais, and Yanomami, and is still learning more. The people in the villages we passed each day were not Indians, although they had Indian ancestry as well as Portuguese, and sometimes African blood, too. But they, too, used many of these plants in their everyday life. From the fronds of the yarina palm, they made their beautiful roofs, which cost them nothing and would last 10 years. In minutes, they could weave a backpack out of fronds of the chambira, strong enough to carry home 100-pound peccary. They grate their manioc, the tuberous staple of the diet, with the spiny stilt roots of raffia. From a buttress of the great Rimo Caspi, they could slice a canoe paddle without killing the tree. By twisting the fibers of the leaves of the young Maximiliana palm, they could instantly create fishing line. They weave bark cloth from the fiber beneath the bark of the Machimongo tree. But perhaps most astonishing, the people also understood the chemical properties of these plants. Tropical plant species, I'd learned from Mark, are twice as likely to contain alkaloids as temperate plants. Alkaloids, which often taste bitter, are a product of eons of chemical warfare waged between these plants and their insect predators. But these chemical compounds, Mark writes in his wonderful book, Tales of a Shaman's Apprentice, also have a major impact on every culture, if not every person, on the planet. Alkaloid compounds are responsible for the zing of caffeine, the numbing of painkillers, the toxicity of deadly poisons, and the transporting powers of hallucinogens. The curative power in these plants sometimes exceed anything medical laboratories can synthesize, Mark says, for their efficacy has already been proven, first by the plants themselves, and then by the people who have used them for millennia. In fact, he points out, tropical plants have already provided some of our most important medicines. The first effective antimalarial drug, quinine, is an alkaloid from the bark of the quinchona tree, first discovered thousands of years ago by Peruvian Indians. Mark firmly believes that the plant knowledge of Amazonian people represents our greatest hope for finding cures to currently incurable diseases, such as AIDS and cancer. From the yellow-flowering retama, Moises told us, the people here make a tea that cures yellow fever. From the bark of the amicia tree comes a potion that cleanses the kidneys. The indano, or iodine, tree's orange bark would cure ringworm and heal rashes. And the elephant ear philodendron contains an anesthetic for toothache. The bark of the root of the Motelo sanango restores male fertility. If the people here knew the secrets of the local plants better than the chemists at home, surely they must know also the secrets of the dolphins. They were obviously excellent observers of natural history. Perhaps they knew where the dolphins went on their travels, whether they lived in family groups, if they hunted cooperatively, how they cared for their young. I asked Moises and Mario if it were possible for us to visit one of the villages to learn from the people what they knew about the pink dolphins. Of course, they told me. In fact, Mario's father and mother lived in San Pedro, only minutes from the lodge. His father, Mario told me through Moises, could certainly tell me about the dolphins, for he knew them well. San Pedro, on the whitewater Quebrada Blanco, is a neat thatched village of 300 people. Most of its residents came here from Chino Village, 5 or 6 miles downstream, which began to flood about 10 years ago, when the river, as is often its wont, changed its course and began to swallow the town. Now more and more people move here each year, as Chino is almost entirely underwater. Piles of Yarina fronds lie drying on yards and on roofs, evidence of new construction. Mario's handsome graying father, Juan, and his lively mother, Hilda, were among the first settlers to build their house on stilts high above the river. They built the house entirely from the forest, the springy 2-inch-wide slats of the floor made of cachapona palm, its wide beams from the red-bark caperona. The house is spacious and feels even more so because items not in use are tucked into the rafters, blowguns and hunting spears, some tin cooking pots, a big drum made of peccary hide for dances and celebrations, the skin of an ocelot Juan killed last year because it was raiding his chickens. In one corner, a 3-year-old was quietly playing with a pet woolly monkey. "My son," said Mario, in a burst of unexpected English and with a broad smile. We gave the boy a handful of hard candy we'd purchased in Iquitos. The charming smile he visited on us in return was so like Mario's, I nearly broke out laughing. I shook hands with Juan. "Please tell him I want to learn about the Bufeo Colorado," I asked Moises, using the name by which Inia is known here, which means the ruddy dolphin. Juan responded in a mixture of Spanish and Quechua, and Moises translated. "The people here have a belief that is true," he said. 5 or 6 years ago," he said, "the waters came very high, and the dolphins swam beneath the houses. The parents of young girls told their children not to wash their clothes in the river in the rainy season. For the male dolphin, he likes the girls, and this can be dangerous. The male dolphins want to take the girls away to the Ancant, and the female dolphins can come for the boys." Last year, Juan said, a dolphin had come for his wife. She had been menstruating, quite a feat for a woman in her 60s, I thought, and left her soiled underclothes on the raft with the washing, which had attracted a dolphin. The next day she felt a pain in her stomach. The pain, he explained, was the result of an invisible dart shot from the blowhole of the dolphin. "So you must be careful when you hear the breath of the dolphin," he warned. "With its loud exhalations, the Bufeo can send forth darts more powerful than those shot from a blowgun. You need a particular type of shaman, called a curandero, to remove them. As part of an elaborate ceremony, he must suck the dart from the flesh with his mouth and then vomit it out. Some of the dolphins here embody the spirits of witch doctors," he said, "and only a shaman can counteract their powers." "What are some of those powers?" I asked. "When he was 10 years old," Juan said, "he lived in the nearby village of Esperanza. There a dolphin visited his powers on his godmother, Cecilia. Her husband went into the jungle to work," he explained, "and sometimes husbands are gone for years. But he came back earlier than Cecilia expected. Every day he brought her delicious fish to eat, and every night he made passionate love to her. But oddly, he was always gone by the time she woke in the morning. A year passed. Then one day her husband came home, but didn't bring her any fish. He brought meat instead. Why? Because he had never brought her any fish. He'd been away for a year." Learning this, Cecilia became pale and sick. No longer did she want to warm their bed with lovemaking. She grew sicker every day and wandered about as if in a trance. Her husband could not understand what was wrong. Finally, he sought the help of a shaman. In a trance, the shaman visited the Ancant. Now he saw what had happened. After her husband had left for the forest, a dolphin had fallen in love with Cecilia. But knowing she would never take a lover, the Bufeo had transformed himself into the very likeness of her husband. In this guise, the dolphin had enjoyed Cecilia's favor every night. But there was more to the story, Mario's father said. The dolphin had fathered a baby that was growing in her womb. In the forest there grows a vine called tumbo that we'd seen on our walk. Twisted, ribbon-like, it reminded me of an umbilical cord. From this vine, women make a potion to induce abortion. Cecilia took the potion and was delivered of the fetus. It had a hole in the top of its head, Juan told me through Moises, the blowhole of a dolphin. I had been looking for facts about an animal, and instead found stories of a phantasm. I'd tried to see beneath the water and had instead climbed into a plant world in the air. Though still I could not chart their courses through the water, I'd followed the dolphins into realms I'd never before imagined they might take me, into treetops, inside black waters, through the looking-glass world of the forest powers. And now they had led me again to new territory, to the people's understanding of the world beneath the river, to the edge of that thin line between animal and human, water and land, fear and desire. Again I felt as if I were back up that Machimongo tree, hanging in midair, staring blindly into the polished surface of some impenetrable mystery. As in Charo Lake, the mystery was still elusive. Only now I was surrounded with it, in far deeper than I thought I would go.